And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Good afternoon and welcome to episode 4722.
Actually, longer than Seinfeld.
It is. We are. We are longer than Seinfeld and
Bart,
The Simpsons right now.
I hope our show ends better.
This show is a show about nothing, so there's that.
Yes, it is. It is. We are back. We are at Chatter on the corner of Wisconsin Avenue and Jennifer Streets Northwest. David Aldridge, Jeannie McManus, Michael Kornheiser, Carol, thank you very much for joining us. Mark Sturt and myself, and we have a terrific show. But David, we have to do a little sporty stuff first.
Go ahead.
So because, as we were talking earlier, I can't watch the Stanley Cup Finals.
Are you really going to talk about this in front of me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Close your ears.
He's in such pain.
Close your little ears.
Hurts him so.
Yeah. So I'm watching basketball.
My friend is here with pizza. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there you go. Pizza?
Was he holding up a sign in the window?
Yes, it was like, say anything.
He has pizza. It's like, I have pizza for you.
Was it Bob Dylan in Subterranean Homesick Blues?
So, David, I know less about basketball than I know about most sports, which is saying a lot.
Oh, wow.
But here's all I know about watching Toronto last night and Golden State Warriors, and we all know how I feel about Steve Kerr and how I feel about Steph.
I forgot to tell him.
Yes.
Sorry, I'll tell him next time.
Next time.
Tell him about his future wife.
Exactly. Yeah. Stand by. It seems like everybody, Golden State Warriors, is hurt or sick or not feeling well, and they're going off to the trainers, and they're coming back, but they still managed to pull it out.
It is.
Doesn't that say a lot about
sure
the
does.
Team?
It says an awful lot about them. It's one of the reasons why, I understand everybody, 47 out of 50 states literally want Toronto to win because everybody's sick of the Warriors. I get it. I understand it. I love excellence.
Yes.
I love watching people who are the best at whatever it is they do what they do.
Yeah. And gutting it out.
They are so much more than just pretty jump shooters, which is how they were dismissed when they first won a championship. They are gritty and tough, and they play defense, and they compete. And when one guy goes down, somebody else comes out of nowhere. Like last night. You know, Andrew Bogut, who literally got signed 2 weeks ago, scored 6 points. You know, Quinn Cook, who's a local guy, went to DeMatha. I love him, but he's not supposed to come in and make 2 3-pointers in the fourth quarter of
the
game.
Oh, yeah, that was crazy.
You know, it's just like yeah, that's what I do. You know, but that's what happens with this team. That's they just go to the next guy, and the next guy delivers because their core four or five people are so incredibly competitive and tough-minded.
It's such a
pleasure to watch them.
It's a gutty, gritty performance.
Yeah.
And you look at Curry and his sheer size or lack thereof and what he does.
And he wasn't feeling
amazing.
Great last night. Yeah.
Wasn't Jordan.
It wasn't on his deathbed, but he was not feeling well and still managed a way to impact the game.
Him at 50%, pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay, back to books.
Yes.
So we have great stuff.
I got distracted. A friend brought me a large Mama Lucia pizza
extra
bacon.
That is so awesome.
Yeah. And we have
thanks, friends.
Yeah. And we have David Marinus in here now. Hi, David. We'll come to you in 10 minutes. What we have on tap for tonight is we do have David Marinus, 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner. I think we've had Pulitzer Prize winners before, but I don't know if we've had
two times.
That's
two
pretty amazing.
More than everybody else in this room.
Exactly. You could add us all.
As Tony says when he plays golf with Tom Friedman, we have 3 Pulitzers amongst
us.
Multiple nominations.
David has written fabulous books about presidents, about athletes, about race, and he has a fantastic book out now called A Good American Family, The Red Scare of My Father, so we'll talk to him about that. We have a little book club therapy. We got an email from somebody seeking a little therapy for their book club. And we're going to tackle the do's and don'ts of summer reading. But I really think summer reading needs to be part one, part two, part three. There's a lot you can cover summer reading.
Sure.
And in Deserted Island, it is wedding season. I wanted that song, Mark. You know, going to the chapel. It's wedding season. So
the Dixie Cups.
The Dixie Cups.
If you can't give them steak knives, what book would you give to the happy couple?
Yes.
A little housekeeping, Calvert Woodley. I was over there this afternoon. I strongly encourage people, if you've never been to Calvert Woodley or if you haven't been for a while, you have to go.
Do it.
The people there spent a lovely little time there this afternoon with Michael Sands, and he had one of one of his people in today. It's our wine of the evening, which comes from the Chateau du Chanteguerre, And I met the deputy CEO, a lovely woman named Chloe. I won't even pretend to pronounce her last name. But she was lovely. And she's they're from Bordeaux, and there's a white and a red. And David and friends, there's some over there if you'd like some.
Please. Please have some.
I said, what should we know about your wines? And she says, well, first of all, our vines, V-I-N-E-S, are very old, as in 60 years old.
Wow.
And she explained to me that they produce less grapes, but they produce better grapes. And the vines have very, very deep root systems, so they get more of the lime and the other things down there. So it's quality versus quantity. But she was absolutely lovely. Michael Sands is going to France for 2 weeks. And then he's going to actually come in and visit with us when he comes back.
Cool. Yep.
And then he also, Jeannie, you like the cheese?
I love the cheese. Yeah. What is that called? This reminds me of the one that we liked about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, we like them all. But the
ones, like them all?
Yeah.
This is the Saint-Nectaire cheese from the Auvergne region of France. And the cows, I learned, Ibrahim's on vacation, but I learned at La Cheeserie, feed on rich volcanic pastures.
Volcanic
I don't know if you can detect the pastures. But
tastes a little lava in there, I must say. It was lovely.
All right. So, Jeannie, book report, report. Where are we? Jeannie, for those of you who don't remember, Jeannie picked The Goldfinch. By Donna Tartt.
Which I am really enjoying rereading.
More than you think you did the first time?
Yeah, the first time, it's a very long book. And the first time I was still working or I was much more distracted. I can focus on it much more now, although I'm only about a third of the way through. But because it's so long, you kind of need to stay on it.
Yep.
And the narrator, the lead character, hops around quite a bit. So you need to remember like what's going on and what has gone before. And also my knowledge of art has increased since I first read it. And that's been very helpful too, especially in the opening pages. There's a lot of references to certain paintings that are hanging in a certain museum when a certain traumatic thing happened. Mm-hmm.
If you really want to drag your book report out a long time, Painful, that's P-A-Y-N-E-F-U-L, on Twitter, pointed out almost immediately when you picked this that there's a movie coming out this fall.
There is?
There is a movie coming out, yep. Nicole Kidman is in it, Luke Wilson is in it, among others, and it's already getting a good little buzz.
Uh-huh.
So just drag this out, and then you'll just have to watch the movie.
Yeah, and I'll be on top of it.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Okay, we look forward to hearing that. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes or no? We're going to go around the table. Mueller Report. Is it a book?
Is it a book? It appears to be a book because I'm looking
just
at it right now.
Just because it's packaged like a book. But is it a book? It's on bestseller lists.
Sure.
It's doing great on bestseller lists, Jeannie.
I'm not sure, but as I read it, which I am, I'm still on volume one.
God bless you.
I think what fun it would be to take some of the devices in the Mueller Report, for example, the redactions, and incorporate them into a novel. Like have a novel like just sort of steaming along and then all of a sudden you turn the page and there's a whole line of blue redaction. And then you steam along for another few pages and then there's a line or two of yellow redaction. And let the reader just kind of jump over those hurdles and figure out what's going on.
Or make up their own.
I'm going to do it.
It sounds like a choose your own adventure.
I love it.
It looks like a book, feels like a book, it's a book.
Sure.
Or Mad Libs. Yeah. Let me bring it down to my level. Michael, book, yes or no?
Yeah, so again, if it
deserves
looks like
to be on the bestseller list competing with David Marinson's fabulous book?
Sure. I think this is a sign of where we are, and it's good to have this as a placeholder that this is what people are choosing to read. That's where I'm going to see value in this. But I do love the idea of turning this into a hilarious piece of fiction that offshoots and everywhere.
Yeah.
Just a great chance to, if you remember Crazy Rich Asians, I was mentioning how they really use footnotes to add a new dimension to the piece. And I think you could have something with that here.
Yeah.
It's pretty, I did not have time to do the research that I want to do, but I want to figure out who gets the money from this. So different entities. I'm sorry, Mark, yes or no? Book?
No, it's not a book.
Thank you. I'm with you.
Have you read it?
This is the good side.
No, because it's not a book.
Okay. All right. So I'm just like, that's kind of a basic question.
Who
the
reads
journalist
cover
asked,
to cover?
Like, have you read it?
No. I'm intimidated by the 400 plus pages. I'm encouraged by the amount of redactions because I think
redactions.
That's getting down to 300
it's
right
a book.
There.
Of course it's a book. It's a narrative. It has a narrative flow. Things happen in this. This is a series of events that are chronicled.
So this is the Washington Post version
yeah, I
of
got
it,
that too.
Packaged together, right? So did they get all the money?
Should the taxpayers
get some of that
money?
I doubt
that the Post, I don't know. I would be surprised if the Post did this for profit, but
I
never
bought
know.
That version too because it had a good prologue and it had a cast of characters.
Sure.
Yes. It was like a very complicated English history book.
Yes.
You would go, you know, here's the line, here are the tutors. And
a
here
nice
are
set
the,
of thank yous.
Yeah.
There's no difference between this and any political book, you know, and I talk about Robert Caro all the time. Robert Caro talked about things that happened in politics.
Yeah.
In a series of events that happened. It was the life of one politician, but it was a series of events that he was present at or not present at. So this is the same thing.
Yeah. I did love Mueller's press conference, or it wasn't even a press conference. His appearance last week.
I'll take no questions. Thank you.
God bless him.
Give him the hand.
Who blames him for that? But I did love he almost plaintively begged people, please read it. Please.
And that really encouraged me to keep plowing through. I confess.
That looks like it was expensive to print with all the black ink for the redactions.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Small margins, too.
So you said no, Tori. So
I said no.
No?
No. Okay. No. And it bothers me that maybe there should be a separate list. But it bothers me. It's on.
If somebody wrote about the report and everything around it,
a lot of pictures,
pictures for me.
You know what's great? The local bookstore, the Browse About in Rehoboth, on their side wall puts the number one selling book for that year up, and it's a beautiful piece of art. But it's a lot of summer reads. But then there's also a couple books that make you a little bit embarrassed about certain years when you look back at them. This could be one of those 5 years from now. Really? That's what we were reading summer 2019?
Oh, come on. It's better than Valley of the Dolls. Really.
Amen. We'll get to that. Okay, well, it might be my summer reading, but we'll get to that. But first, we have Book Club Therapy. Mark, would you like to read this one?
I don't know. Would I?
You have to. Some of the words are capitalized. You have to point out.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm trying to. Oh, has this been redacted? Is book
yes,
club members?
Yes, because we're protecting their anonymity.
Book club members from a white elephant neighborhood. Okay. Hi, everybody. Love the podcast. Our problem is this: our book club has one longtime member who never reads the books.
That's in caps. Never.
Yes, I tried to emphasize that. Did I do that? Okay.
All caps.
She jokes about it all the time, changes the topic, and diverts us from discussing the book because she never reads the books.
All caps.
When we're at her house, she does provide good wine and snacks. Maybe that's the only reason we keep her in the club. So what should we do? Confront her, ignore her, or something else? Signed, the book members from the White Elephant Neighborhood.
I'll go first. Dump her.
Absolutely.
You can always get good snacks. You can get good wine and cheese from CW. Yeah.
Yeah. If it's causing aggravation within the club, I mean, I'm with you. Send her walking.
I'm with Tori. It's fine. Maybe you show up once or twice and go, I didn't have time to read the book. I've had a horrible week or month or whatever.
But if you revel in it.
Yeah.
Or there's one book that doesn't connect with you.
Right. And you put it down. And then to distract the purpose of the club with your own sort of narcissistic issues.
I love visiting these independent bookstores, and they all host book clubs, and they tend to be long-term book clubs who have gotten into so much angst that they needed a nonpartisan MC, if you will, to take care of their book clubs. So they don't have them in the homes anymore.
Could we make her do a series of punishments, perhaps?
Good.
Like maybe run a mile in 12 minutes or something.
With a glass of Chardonnay in hand.
Exactly.
No, Michael? This has to go beyond just kicking her out in true white elephant neighborhood fashion. And again, we're thinking of these neighborhoods.
Good point.
To create a shadow book club so she still thinks that she's leading the pack and involved, but you have a real book club that meets just on opposite nights of the week.
How devious.
And she's going down the street and she sees them all going into somebody
just
else's
sees
house.
Yeah, it's like an up-dike short story. She just sees the lights on from the street.
I love that. Okay, so keep sending in your book club angst to us, tori@chatteronbooks.com. They really are fun. There were one or two where people said, okay, I just want you, they wanted to vent. They didn't want them read, but I just want to vent.
We'll protect your identity.
Exactly.
Let us read them.
Gladys.
Yeah.
Zach.
From Tunlaw Street.
Right.
Yeah. In the White House. Okay. So I think we're a week or two out from the official start of summer, right? But we're almost there.
Yes.
Beautiful day here at the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer.
Yes.
I'll need to put the shades on when we have David move over.
Yes.
But Jeannie and I were kicking around ideas a few weeks ago about talking about summer reading. And you can talk about delivery mechanism. You can talk about kind of book. But let's just start going around. The fundamental question for me about summer reading, Michael, we'll go to you first. Is it okay to put down War and Peace and pick up the trashy novel for summer reading?
Yes. Now, by summer reading, are you talking about personal summer reading
personal
for yourself,
summer
or
reading.
Say something that you might read?
Yeah, we're
going
to come
class.
Back to you torturing students, but just you personally. Is
oh,
it okay
yeah.
to?
Totally. There's something about a summer beach read that needs to, the spine of the book needs to be broken. Mm-hmm. If it's a paperback, it needs to be losing the color because it's sunned out, it's bleached out, it's got salt spray on it, the pages are beginning to crackle. That's what you need to see.
The circle from the wine glass?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Genie delivery mechanism?
Well,
hardcover, paperback, Kindle?
Sitting on the beach, I don't want to bring my e-reader down there. I don't want to bring my phone down there. I want to bring some cheesy paperback, as Michael just suggested. And I often go into the cottage that we're renting, and, you know, there's always like 5 bookshelves full mm-hmm. of abandoned summer reading books. And I'll just grab one of those. And then, like, you throw it down on the sand and a wave comes crashing up over it.
It doesn't really matter.
It's no loss.
It adds texture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. David?
It's so weird. I actually take my Kindle to the beach. It's so weird. I get
you can see it with the glare and everything?
I grant you. It's very weird. I know I shouldn't. But I keep it in a plastic, like a baggie, so that the sand doesn't get on it, and you can still read through it.
Wait, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You keep it in a baggie?
Yeah, like a
Do you take it out when you're reading?
Bag. No. You keep it in the baggie.
How do you turn the pages?
You still can press the buttons.
How can you see the words? Doesn't it?
No, you can see the words.
Never seen that.
I'm very weird.
Yeah,
very
that's
weird
very strange.
Toy. Yes, I grant you that.
Mark, delivery mechanisms?
I used to be the paperback guy on the beach, and it was always... For me, it was always like a trashy spy thriller novel.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get enough of those. But I have really converted over. I don't have a Kindle, but I have a Kindle app on my phone.
Yeah.
So I just now this is where, because if I'm reading something and I'm like, yeah, you know what, I'm kind of bored with this now, then you can just immediately switch over to something else.
Yeah.
Plus, I have like 5 million songs on iTunes on my phone, right. So I listen. So this is like my entire entertainment center that just goes with me everywhere.
So thoughts on audiobooks at the beach?
No, I like to read. But I do use audiobooks, but that's mostly when I'm going to sleep. Like, I'll put those on as, like, background noise and drift off. Because you can set the timer, like, you know, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, mm-hmm. 15 minutes, whatever you want. And as long as you have a really good narrator, it puts you out like that.
I listen to books a lot. I spend so much time in my car. Mm-hmm. And as you all know, if I can read a book and listen to it, I will do that. But I find myself, and this is all about cognitive whatever, I will be driving down the road and listening to a book and really, really enjoy it and go, mm-hmm. oh, wait, I'm in New Jersey. I didn't mean to be here.
Whoops.
Highway hypnosis.
Really bad. I don't remember going through toll booths. I don't remember.
This is not my state.
Right. Okay, Michael, when I hear summer reading, I do think back to required summer reading lists. I hated them as a child. I resented them as a parent with my kids. I thought, you know, teach my kids in the 9 months you have them, then let me have them for 3 months, which they never do. But give us your take as a teacher on required summer reading lists. And if you ruled the world and could say, this is what every, pick a grade, eighth grade had to read this summer, what would it be?
This is an impossible task, but there's nothing that signals the end of summer, the cicadas coming in through the open windows, like going to your local bookstore and having your kid say, I had to read 3 of 5 books from this list, and I don't have any of them. Preseason starts tomorrow. It all comes down to purpose. So many of these lists are just placeholders where various teachers, as they've come into a department or left, they just keep adding more and more and more. And it's traditionally big, long, lengthy novels that are trying to prove something.
Yep.
So I would always question the teacher, why do you want them to read this? What is the purpose? As you come back to purpose. I'm okay if you want to say, I think there's value in having a kid sit down to a lengthy book that has difficulty. There's something they can take away from that they've tackled this over, say, 6 to 8 weeks, and they've learned how to set goals. They've had the chance to talk about this with their parents, with their friends. Obviously, that doesn't always happen. But I also want to see something.
Yeah, it happens the night before class starts.
Hey,
in
Mom,
September.
What are your thoughts on, say, a movie you had to read? No, so it are you going to use it in class? I hate books where they say, read these 3 books, and then you walk in the first day having dutifully taking notes, and they say, there's no test, there's no paper, this was just an activity for you.
Yeah.
Come on, man. Honestly. So I don't think you need to have a big, you know, exam on it. You don't have to have a big paper, but is it something that you're going to thread throughout the year that might be thematically connected to what you're doing in class? When I was thinking about this, I'm having a lot of fun. I would come back for any grade 9 through 12, which is where I spend most of my mm-hmm. time. I would assign the Odyssey for any class. And a lot of it is because the more I reflect back on my teaching, I want to have something that's going to meet a lot of different students. And what's great is you can be a middle schooler, you can be a graduate yep. student, and you're going to be able to tackle something within that text. Mm-hmm. If you're new to the school, new to the area, let's say you've already read it, we might be using a different translation. I want you to bring in that expertise as you try and help us out, saying why this translation might be a little bit different. How does the rhythm affect your understanding? And so much of it plays back to having kids reflect back on their summer. We have a story that's about a wanderer. It's taken a long time to get home. And I want you to wrestle with that as you wander through your summer. I don't care if you pick it up week one, put it down for a month and a half, and then slowly get back to it. I'm okay if you bring that wandering back into it. And this idea of home. Let's say you're about to enter high school. Are you going to try and learn more about yourself? Are you going to try different affects as you enter different phases? You might be a different kid than you were last year, but there should be this sense of home, whether it's going to be family, whether it's going to be a sense of self that you can always come back to. So there's a lot of interesting stuff. We all remember that really prescriptive lesson about hospitality, or we understand about, you know, tests and proving yourself and loyalty as Odysseus comes back and dresses up as someone else to try and test these people. But there's a lot of cool activities that you can do. I would love to do something with the oral tradition and having kids look at the story itself as one large flower petal. And so often we see the story meandering, wandering again as you mm-hmm. as you go through your late July days away from that main thread. But because it's an oral tradition, it always comes back to that main piece that's going to propel us forward. We have a lot of the story we find out by looking back. And I think that'd be a really cool way to try and have us practice the oral tradition ourselves, but also have kids, as we're thinking about setting a culture for the year and something that we're going to use, almost create their own class tapestry, if we're thinking back to Penelope, and bringing in their own beliefs and experiences, expectations, what they want from that year, and we create this web that we can have as a living document on the wall that we can trace back throughout the entire year.
Excellent.
But
I always think I should have been in one of Michael's classes.
Yeah.
Maybe I would have gone to school.
I hope you don't expect any of us to follow up on that.
No. I have another book.
Could you do that in the summer? That couldn't be a summer reading thing. That had to be.
No, you can do that as a summer reading. Now, what's great is, again, you would have some kids who would read this in the course of 1 week because they get lost in the story. And I would love that idea of flow, a kid who meets a story that they can't get enough of. You could also have a very, very rigid reader who says, I have a guide. I would call them guideposts, checkposts as to how am I reading. But that's a whole other lesson as to how do you goal set so that you get through this.
God bless you. Okay. We're going to take a break and come back with Dave Marinus. But when we come back next time for summer reading, I want to talk about how I'm sick on these lists and the celebrity lists and some of the major newspapers in our country saying you must read these books this summer. If I read another one that says it's Hillbilly Elegy.
Oh, yeah.
Enough already. I didn't like the original Hillbilly Elegy.
Right.
So let's take a break and we will come back with David. And we're back, I think. So we are back. We are back with David Marinus. David, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
First
quite a
of
crowd.
Your many interviews in a bar?
I've interviewed people in bars before.
Yes.
But
different.
I don't think
you're on the other end now.
Now you're on the receiving end.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us. And we are going to spend a lot of time talking about A Good American Family, which is a remarkable, I think, very timely book. A lot of people who will be listening to this podcast know you, and they probably feel as they know you very well because of all the things you've written about and all the people you've written about, presidents, athletes, etc. But I bet they didn't know you were a hop-along Cassidy fan.
You've read
you
the
wanna,
book. That's good. That's really good.
You want to explain that fascination?
Well, he was just my guy. I don't know why. He wore a dark suit instead of a white suit. I love the name.
Uh-huh.
There actually was a football player that David might remember whose nickname was Hopalong Cassidy.
Yes.
He played for the Detroit Lions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so that might have been part of it.
There you go.
Yeah.
And
you could do a little dance
I
like
did
him?
A little cowboy dance.
When we go video, you can come back and do the dance.
Standing.
Okay, so you've written all Obama, Clinton, Vince Lombardi, Roberto Clemente, God bless you, the Rome Olympics. How did all of those books and the work you did for them prepare you or help you write this book, which was about the MacArthur era, about the Red Scare, through your family, particularly your father?
Well, you know, for all of those books, I was dealing with people who were strangers to me at the beginning
uh-huh.
and spent 4 years or so plumbing the depths of their lives until I became very familiar with them. And here was the exact opposite, mm-hmm. where, you know, my parents, I thought I knew them intimately, and I was going to try to figure out their lives. All of us have mythologies in our families that are passed along from generation to generation.
Right.
Very few of us have biographers going back to find out what's real and what isn't.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to apply the same methodology I used for all of those other biographies for this one. I talk about the four legs of
right.
the table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first one is go there. So for this book, my uncle, who's an instrumental part of the book, fought in the Spanish Civil War. My wife and I went to Spain and traced his route. The second one is go to the archives. So I went to 13 different archives for this book to get different documents. The third one is to interview everyone I can. In this case, most people were dead, but there were still descendants who were around. So one of the figures in the book is a woman who was a grandmother spy who named hundreds of names. I found her grandchildren, and they
wow.
talked to them about it. And the fourth one is to try to look for what's not there, to break through the conventional stories that everybody tells and find the real
mm-hmm.
truth.
One of the interviews I saw you do, you said you don't like to just, I'm not going to write a book just to write about a famous person, or in this case, just to write the book to write about your dad. But you're always looking for two things, a dramatic story and themes that illuminate the sociology and history of America. What did you learn about sociology and the history of America through this one?
Well, you know, I started this book in 2015, before Donald Trump. What I learned is something I already knew, which is that history doesn't repeat itself precisely, but the themes come around again mm-hmm. and again. Mm-hmm. So the central themes of this book are the use of fear and hysteria for political purposes, the narrow definitions of what it means to be an American, and those important themes, along with the ever-important realization that our American democracy is dependent upon civil liberties, sort of came through in my study of this book as well as what's happening today.
Mm-hmm. Your brother wasn't entirely enthusiastic about you doing this book, your older brother.
No, he in retrospect now he says he didn't try to talk me out of it, but I have the emails.
The receipts.
A good reporter.
But I love my older brother Jim. He's a just retired professor of Spanish at Amherst College, much smarter than I am. And it wasn't that he was embarrassed by what our parents were doing. It was that my father didn't talk about it, and Jim thought to respect our parents, I shouldn't write a book about it. I think also he was 6 years old when this started, when my father was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. I was two. He remembers it. So I think he thinks it's more his story than mine.
It might have been more traumatic for him.
Oh, it definitely
was. 6 years old, yeah. You start to understand things.
He had friends saying, your father's a commie. He and my older sister went to three schools mm-hmm. in one semester because we were bouncing around. It definitely was more traumatic for him. I mean, the trauma for me might have been subconscious. I mean, I don't know what happens right. to a three-year-old when all those things are going on. I definitely know that my sensibility is shaped somewhat by that period. But, yeah, you're right. It was more his trauma than mine.
So we learned so much. One of the things I loved is because one of our kids goes to Michigan. So this is all over Ann Arbor and University of Michigan and
yeah.
Arthur Miller. It was absolutely remarkable. But was it a struggle to talk about what your parents were doing? Because I know some in the book, one of the things you talk about how you couldn't reconcile that your father, he called himself a newspaper man, right?
Right.
A reporter, not a journalist, because
right.
that would be too snooty. But you couldn't reconcile that he was a journalist with his advocacy of his political beliefs, which in this case, the Communist Party.
I could reconcile the idealism and the issues that drew him in that direction. Which are the failures of capitalism during the Great Depression, which were evident everywhere he was. The rise of Nazism and fascism in Europe, you know, in Italy and Germany. And the always present racial injustice of this country. So those are the issues that drew him towards that place. But there were many times when I was reading the editorials he wrote as the editorial director of the Michigan Daily where I was sort of shaking my head and saying, come on, Dad. You know, he rationalized the Nazi-Soviet pact in 1939, which it was a interesting editorial, but I think it's indefensible. And there were certain points along the way where I felt that. But I also, throughout that period, from his time at the University of Michigan till 1952 when he was called before the committee, in all of his writing, you could see his love for America.
Yes.
You know, not that he was advocating the violent overthrow of the government, which is the basis on which all of these people were attacked, but that he thought America wasn't living up to its standards. He was blinded to the realities of the Soviet Union, and that's a fact. But his motivations, his love of America, are equally clear. You can hold that contradiction in one person.
Did you ever talk about these things with him when he was alive, or did you ever read? So he had a lot of writing that you could go back and find.
You know, first of all, the I found, when I was researching the book, hundreds of letters he wrote to my mother when he was the commander of an all-black unit in World War II, which are amazing and show his deep commitment to racial justice in a very difficult situation where young black men were being asked to fight and die for liberty and democracy in a country that treated them as second-class citizens. He understood that and was working to give them a feeling that they were getting a fair shake in his company. I also lucked out that the University of Michigan, Bentley Historical Library, had just digitized the entire backlog of the Michigan Daily. I, you know, instead of spending a few months trying to find all those, I typed in Elliot Marinus and up came 250 hits. Yep. So I could read all of that.
So speaking of finding, you went to the archives and you found a statement your father had written.
When my father was called before the committee in 1952, he wanted to deliver a statement. I knew about that part of it because the transcript of any congressional hearing is a matter of public record. And so I had already read about that even before I ever decided to do this book. But in that transcript, you see my father saying, I have a statement I'd like to give to the committee about what I think it means to be an American. And the chairman of the committee, John Stevens Wood, a racist from Georgia who had voted against every civil rights bill that came along, who had briefly belonged to the Ku Klux Klan as a young man, and had, even in another stunning thing, had driven the car that carried the lynched body of Leo Frank, a Jewish industrialist who was lynched in Atlanta on a false accusation of murder in 1913. The committee chairman had driven the car that carried his lynched body. Anyway, this person denied my father the right to deliver the statement. If my father had sort of sought absolution for his sins and confessed and named names, they would have let him read the statement. They didn't. So that statement was buried until I went to the National Archives in 2015, found the box of documents about those hearings in Detroit, found a folder that said Elliot Marinus, opened it up, and there was his statement, three pages.
And he had never told you about that?
No, he'd never talked about any of this, really. I had, long ago, as David and Jeannie would understand, I once tried to write a novel, and I'm a nonfiction journalist, and it was pathetic. So, but it was going to be about 1 year that my family spent in a small town in Iowa right before Salvation came. So this was, the novel would have taken place in 1956. And I tried to interview my father for that, and it didn't go anywhere. He really didn't want to talk about it. And I don't think it was because he was embarrassed about it. He just didn't want to be defined by that part of his life. He had so successfully moved beyond that in so many ways. It taught me all of the sort of lessons that I took with me into my journalism career. Don't fall for any rigid ideology. Search for the truth wherever it takes you. That was the father that I knew.
Stick up for the underdog?
Yes, definitely stick up for the underdog.
Also, don't you think that that generation, for example, the men who served in World War II, did not want to come back and talk? They were the opposite of the Me Too generation.
They never did talk about it.
They were reticent about so much. Do you think that was part of that?
You know, I'm not sure, yes. I mean, he would talk about, you know, playing poker on the boat over to Okinawa, you know, but not talk about the rest of that. And I think that to some degree, the analogy is that I think there was some post-traumatic stress for him for the crucible that he was in with UAC. And it was similar to maybe being in combat in that sense.
And he talk about the impact on your family. I lost his job. He was fired
the
twice.
The day that the grandmother spy testified as the star witness and named hundreds of names, one of which was Elliot Marinus, my father was delivered a subpoena at the Detroit Times and summarily fired. And from that moment, for 5 years, our family bounced around. First, we lived with his parents in a small apartment in Coney Island in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. He worked briefly for a newspaper called The Compass. It folded a month after he got there. We moved back to Ann Arbor, lived with my mother's parents briefly. Then he got hired by the Cleveland Plain Dealer when some friends of his from the University of Michigan days hired him there. But the FBI came to the Plain Dealer and said, you just hired a former communist. He was fired from that job. Mm-hmm. We moved back to Detroit, a few apartments in Detroit, where he was out of the newspaper profession entirely, selling party favors for labor unions at picnics, sort of a pathetic job for anyone who knew my dad.
But he had to feed his family.
He did. And then finally, there was a newspaper strike in Davenport, Iowa, by the typographical union, and they set up a labor paper, a strike paper, and they hired my father to be the editor of that. As it so happened, that little paper every few weeks would run a column called Hello Wisconsin, written by the old progressive publisher of the Madison Capital Times, William T. Evue, a good friend of Fighting Bob La Follette. Evue saw this little strike paper. My father was a great journalist. He was brilliant at layout, at headlines. My favorite headline he ever wrote was when Bing Crosby died. His headline was, Bing Crosby dies at 74, two over par. It was on a golf course that he died of a heart attack. The average age of a man at that time was 72, so it fit in both ways.
Spectacular.
Anyway, so he was a great journalist, and Evue saw this little paper down there and how neat it looked, and he said, who's doing this? It's better than our paper. That strike paper folded. Evue hired my father. We moved up to Madison in the summer of 1957. Joseph McCarthy, the name who gave his name to that whole era, had just died. Mm-hmm. The Milwaukee Braves were on their way to winning the World Series. We moved near the Vilas Park Zoo, and everything seemed good. It was our salvation.
For you, a nice young boy, it must have seemed great. Idyllic. What would your dad think of social media?
You know, my father was a realist. I remember, you know, he went through the transition from manual typewriters to electric typewriters to computers. And, you know, I was the one who in the family was sort of a troglodyte and would complain about all this. And my dad would say, platforms are going to change. Life always changes. You adjust to the change. And the two things that don't change are the need for humans to understand one another through storytelling, like the Odyssey, you know, all the way from there to now, and the search for truth. And as long as those two things are happening, the formats are not as important.
Yeah. Okay.
But in terms of tweeting and all that, I think he would tell me, stop.
Just don't do it. All right. Here's my favorite line from his statement that he was not allowed to give. That's what makes this committee, HUAC, so dangerous, ostensibly designed to protect the government against overthrow by force and violence. It proceeds by force, terror, and threats to overthrow the rights of the American people. We tend to have a he whose name shall not be spoken on this show because it keeps us out of trouble.
Oh, okay.
But what
I'm sorry,
would
I already
he,
named it once.
What would he, no, what would your dad say? We'll keep it out of any of us. What would your dad say about the current occupant and the tactics he uses?
You know, my father was an eternal optimist. I don't know where he got that from, but he inculcated that in me. And so I think he would say, we've been through worse. We'll get through this. This guy is different than any president we've ever had. But in the long term, good will prevail if we remember to honor civil liberties and to vote and to be active.
Yeah.
I think that would be his basic line. But I'm almost glad that my parents aren't around to see this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, my mother.
Yeah, talk about your mother, because she was a big. Back when John McCain and Mark Salter did their first book, Faith My Father's, I called them up and said, you guys are full of this, because John McCain's mother was huge influence on his life, right? And still is, 105, driving around.
Right.
But talk about your mother a little bit.
My mother, Mary Cummins, was a townie. She met my dad at the University of Michigan.
Say the day in which they met.
They met the day that my uncle, her older brother, came back from the Spanish Civil War, and there was a huge celebration for the two survivors from the University of Michigan. 600 people came to the Michigan Union. Among them, Bob Cummins' little sister, 17-year-old blonde townie, Mary Cummins, and covering the event for the Michigan Daily was a senior, Elliot Marinus. And it was at that event that my parents met.
Which is fabulous. Yeah.
And
but
my mother...
She was very active.
She was very active. She was probably more ideological than my dad. Mm-hmm. You know, was a member of the Young Communist League at the University of Michigan. Like my father... evolved into a sort of a classic bleeding heart liberal, and I say that in the best sense. I mean, she was a wonderful, open to the world human being who really kept our family together during that very difficult period. She tried to buy a house wherever we bounced around to just make the kids feel stable. I mean, imagine living in a little cooped up apartment in Coney Island with your in-laws and three little kids. I mean, and you know, that was sort of the life that she had to endure for the 5 years. When we got to Madison, she went back to the University of Wisconsin, was Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Wisconsin, and got a job as a book editor at the University of Wisconsin Press. And it was really, you know, when I started writing books, I'd send the manuscripts back to my parents. And sometimes I could be on the phone and they'd be arguing with each other for a half an hour over something, and I was just listening to them because they, you know, my dad was the newspaper bad guy and my mother was a stickler for, you know, she was more probably more like Mike Kornheiser, you know, in terms of or the grammar being correct and everything. And so, but she was a wonderful human being who really opened up our house to everybody who came through Madison.
Yeah. How do you feel, or do you feel differently about your parents having done all this research and read those hundreds of letters? How do you feel differently about them, if you do?
You know, Tori, I think I have a... I feel differently about them and about myself, and I understand why I am the way I am because of the sensibility that they gave me. You know, the process of dealing with parts of your parents' life that you disagree with is, you know, it's difficult, but it was an intellectual disagreement. It wasn't an emotional or psychological disagreement, which would be more difficult, I think, for kids. So I could understand where they were coming from. I could see the blindness of some of their thoughts about the Soviet Union. But I admired their bravery. I'm standing up to power. And I admired the way they survived and got through it and kept our family together and taught their children the lessons that they had endured.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So you've written about presidents, about race, about great athletes, about your family. What's next?
Jim Thorpe.
Oh. Can't wait.
Nice.
I've started the research for that one. And, you know, like you said at the beginning, I'm looking for a dramatic story and some larger sociological meaning. He's got both.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I view this as an opportunity to write about the experience of the American Indian from the 1890s to the 1950s, you know, when the whole government policy was kill the Indian, save the man, you know, beat the Indian out of them. They couldn't do that to Jim Thorpe. He was considered the greatest athlete of the first half of the 20th century, Major League Baseball player, and a founder of the NFL, and an Olympic decathlete gold medalist.
Not much. Great. Well, this book, which everyone should go out and buy, and don't buy the Mueller Report, just get that at your local library.
You got to buy it because it's for profit, apparently.
Exactly. By the way, Mark, he's not Robert Caro. I'm sorry.
No, I said Robert Caro. I said Robert Caro.
Okay, I didn't mean to insult you that. No, don't even try that.
Everyone should go buy A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father by David Marinus. David, thank you so much. Come back with Jim Thorpe, okay?
I'd love to.
Great. Thank you. Now we'll take a break and come back with Deserted Island. Catchy. It really gets you after a while. Okay, we're back. David Marinus had to go. He had to race off to yet another event to talk about his fabulous book. It one of the things I loved about this book, A Good American Family, you could read a chapter or two, put it down, read a chapter or two, put it down. He is just wonderful. There was so much we couldn't get to. Arthur Miller. Big part of that.
Yeah. And went to high school with his father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Marilyn Monroe. Mm-hmm. Okay. But now we're on to Deserted Island. It is wedding season. As I said, if you're not going to give them steak knives, what would you give them? As a book, Michael?
I have two books. Is that okay?
That's absolutely
okay. Well, the first
okay.
gift would be a toaster oven.
Of course.
We know that. Or a fire extinguisher.
Or steak knives.
Yes, obviously. Yeah. Well, steak knives, you already, it's already taken care of. No, the first, this is one of the most talked about books from the past year. And I think it deserves more time on its own. But for wedding season, I'm going to offer Normal People by Sally Rooney. And this is a very, I would say, stripped down prose. It's just very strong. And it's a story of first love. But I would, really, we're looking at something that's going to look at class distinctions and how that affects your growing up together and the way you move in and out. But so much of this is an economic transaction. And when we look at weddings and marriage and the prospect of that union, I want the couple to see sort of the bad side of this economic transaction. We have a toxic relationship, that there is a lot of beauty to that first love, but each one of them is taking something from the relationship. They're adding a lot to it, but there's a lot of take at various times, and so much of this could be solved by good communication. And it's easier to see, obviously, when it's somebody else. And you look it back to one simple high school dance. All you had to do was ask the girl, mm-hmm. and how much heartbreak would have been saved over the next, say, 5 years of your life. So I really want to see this as this, it's sort of a throwback idea with marriage as this economic transaction. We're looking at credits and debits that you're supplying. And the second book that I would give would be a little bit lighter, but it gives a lot of space to just think about what you're bringing to a relationship, and that would be The Giving Tree. And a lot of times we see this as a primer for literary criticism, as you look at sort of the, you might look at, say, a mother who's giving all for her child. And here, you can give the tree, even though she has a feminine pronoun. Either partner can be the tree. And again, it's, what are you taking away, or what are you adding to the relationship? And there's one line that comes back throughout the whole piece, after the tree does something. So the little boy, climb on my branches, mm-hmm. take my fruit. He does, goes away, and the tree was happy. And it's that lingering, and the tree was happy, that is so blinding as to what are you giving to a relationship where you feel happy, you are deluding yourself, you are happy, but you slowly are turning into that stump.
Mm. Nice.
Wow.
Nice. Probably should have let Michael go last. Always. We should probably always yeah. let always. Michael go, right? Jeannie?
Well, mine is a lot more cynical than Michael's, as one might expect.
Wait till you get to mine.
I am a great reader of advice columns, and I've noticed that 70% of the questions in advice columns usually have something to do with a wedding, with so-and-so doesn't want this bridesmaid, they've disinvited this person, the family, this half of the family won't come. And so I turned to one of my favorite books, Miss Manners Guide to a Surprisingly Dignified Wedding. And she obviously writes with a great deal of cynicism and sarcasm. And here's just a brief excerpt. She provides some of the most commonly held ideas that are passed around as, quote, etiquette. Quote, that the bride is granted dictatorial powers that hardly exist outside of prisons. How everyone is to look, dress, and behave, as well as control over others' money. That it is outrageous for the couple's mothers to seek any input, but that the wedding are sufficiently complicated that a professional wedding planner must be hired to provide the guidance and experience mothers offer for free. That a wedding consists of a series of events, a showily staged proposal, an engagement party, multiple showers, separate risque outings for bride and bridegrooms 2 nights before the wedding, organized sports and a dinner party for everyone the day before, an all-night party after the ceremony for anyone still standing, and a brunch the following day.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So anyway, this is a book that I would give to
maybe
a bride
this is an
en-
well, maybe
on her
an engagement,
engagement,
engagement.
Or at her wedding shower before she becomes bridezilla.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea. David?
I have a book that I like a lot. It's called The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. It became became an Oprah thing, but it was a very good book.
And it is. That's great.
Yeah, and it's.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can we stop? Sure. Mark knows something that Oprah recommended.
Yeah, no,
it's a learned man.
Adam Ferrara recommended that to me, and it was it was terrific. Yeah. No, I really liked it.
And it's a great book. Not so much about what two people do together, but how, by making yourself a better person, you make yourself a better spouse or a better partner for someone else. And it's basically, there's four things that he says you have to do. You have to be impeccable with your word. you have to not take anything personally, you have to not make assumptions, and you have to always do your best. And that all sounds kind of treacly, but it's also kind of true.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so if you do those things, one of the things he says about love is, if someone is not treating you with love and respect, it is a gift if they walk away from you. If that person doesn't walk away, you will surely endure many years of suffering with him or her. Walking away may hurt for a while, but your heart will eventually heal. Then you can choose what you really want. You will find that you don't need to trust others as much as you need to trust yourself to make the right choices. So, I mean, it's just about, you know, listening to yourself
that
a little
could
bit.
Be, that sounds like a good anniversary gift book, too.
Mm-hmm.
Not just a marriage, but a good anniversary gift. My dad used to always like to tell all of us that the wedding was the least important part of the marriage. Now, that may have something to do with that he had five girls, but... okay, so mine is by a wonderful guy named Frank Wisner, W-I-S-N-E-R, and it's called Honeymoon with My Brother. And I knew Frank. He worked on the Hill, I worked on the Hill, and then I kind of lost touch with him. And one year, I'm talking to somebody else, and I go, hey, what's... We have anyways, they say, oh, you didn't hear, he's got a book out, and Honeymoon with My Brother, because he and his soon-to-be broke it off days before the wedding, but everything was paid for, and the honeymoon was paid for, so he took his brother with him on the honeymoon, and it was this wonderful story. I'm shocked that it has not been turned into a movie, because he really learned so much, kind of to what you were just saying, mm-hmm. He learned so much about himself, and he says, if I had known that before, then maybe we wouldn't have gone down this path, but it's absolutely lovely.
It is
Mark?
Lovely. Well, I think The Art of War.
Perfect.
No, I struggled with this. Well, first of all, I'm the only one here that's never been married.
As far as we know.
Right.
No,
as far as you know.
No, I'm pretty sure. I'll check at the house, but I'm pretty sure. And I don't... Are books given as gifts at weddings?
Okay, I won't name names, but as we were saying before the show, someone gave us a Bible for our wedding.
Okay.
And they signed it.
Signed it?
Which is just odd. Jesus. It's not Jesus Christ.
The giver was not Jesus Christ.
It was okay. As far as we know.
Right. Or Moses or...
Abraham.
Yeah.
None of the big characters in the book. No. No. So
Charlton Heston.
Because, you know, I don't even give presents now at weddings. Because after I watch Goodfellas, now I just give cash because I'm like, I kind of want to be in the mob. It looks kind of cool.
Yeah.
So, no, the only thing I could think of, because I thought of Shakespeare, I thought of, you know, Romeo and Juliet. But it doesn't end well.
No.
So that's not really...
No.
But the Tristan and Isolde, I think that's a beautiful tale.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh,
you know,
nice.
Lovers that sort of get separated and they find their way back to each other.
Yeah.
And they have their issues. And I love... I don't read a lot of romantic novels. I know that's coming as a shock to all of you guys. But that is one that I remember from the days of my youth that I would give... Would that be
absolutely.
Met with satisfaction?
Or very nice.
Would they look at me and be like, you idiot?
No, it'd be
great. Like that a lot.
I'd want to give the guy, like the old man in the sea, and be like, eventually this is going to be you. Okay?
He's going to
get
roses.
Away from
Yeah. Fabulous. Okay. I like this segment. Okay. Now we're going to take... We're done.
We are done.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm still in awe of David Marinus.
Oh, that was just fantastic.
And you're just sitting here. And I was reading this book, and I kept looking up some of his other stuff. The body of work he has crammed into that life.
Can't wait for the Jim Thorpe book.
I know.
Yeah.
That's going to be great. What do we got coming up next week?
What we have coming up next week. Next week is John Ward, who is a really interesting guy. Yahoo correspondent, covers a lot of politics, this and that. But he has a book out called Camelot's End, and it is about the epic, epic, epic clash, and I was there, between Teddy Kennedy and Jimmy Carter in 1980.
Ooh.
Absolutely remarkable.
Ooh, wow, can't wait for that.
Yeah, and he's fun, so that'll be terrific. So come back, and thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.